Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, April 16th, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, virus protection, part of our April Home Security Month on Geek Speak. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on the Geeks, and then click on Send a Message to get in our queue right now. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks: John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, Sean Cleveland, technical marketing communications manager for Transmeta, and Miles Elam, programmer and student of American literature. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thanks, Lyle.
Good morning, Lyle.
Before we get into our discussion about virus protection, let's cover a little bit of geek news. We'll start with Sean today. Sean?
Yeah, big news this week. For all you gamers out there, NVIDIA just launched their new GeForce 6800 series of video cards. This latest card has some pretty cool features. The chip that powers it, the NV40, has about 200 million transistors, which I think breaks the record right now.
How does that compare to like a processor?
Processors typically have, I think the Athlon XP has upwards of 80 million, and the Pentium 4, I believe, has 120 million.
And this has
200 million.
Wow. So what does this mean for a consumer that would purchase this card?
Well, that doesn't in itself doesn't really mean a lot. But let me tell you a little more about the features, and
that'll
answer your question. This card will run about 500 megahertz. It's got some really interesting features as far as 16 pipelines and 32 shader units. Now, you don't need to understand graphics, but just know that this is a completely redesigned architecture. And the speed of the graphics of this card are, well, from what I'm hearing, twice as fast as that of the last generation, the FX.
And what we're really talking about is 3D rendering, normally in the game environment.
Correct.
And
this is just
twice as fast as the last rev.
That's taken every reviewer that's reviewed this card is just going nuts with it. If you go to extremetech.com, it's a Ziff Davis site. They do some excellent reviews up there, and they have good coverage of the card. And I've got the latest issue of Maximum PC. And they have the print exclusive. I just got it this morning, actually, so I haven't really read it yet. But this new card also has what's called GDDR3 memory, which allows engineers to pack more memory on top of the board so that it doesn't have to have a heat sink on the back of the board. If you've noticed, the cards lately have just had these huge fans and these huge heat sinks on both sides. So they're trying to bring that down.
Now, this card is called again?
It is called the GeForce 6800 series, and it's the chip is made by NVIDIA.
And so is the card, I'm assuming.
NVIDIA doesn't actually sell cards. They just design the chips. The cards will be available from a bunch of different people. I'm not sure who. A bunch of different companies.
Well, Sean, thanks for the update on 3D graphics. John.
Good morning. In the news this week, on Tuesday, Ford announced that finally they're releasing their hybrid vehicle, which is the Ford Escape. It's a small-sized SUV. Hybrid technology, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is battery and electrical and gasoline-powered vehicles that get better gas mileage and have fewer emissions. The new Escape will have Prius-like emissions, old-style Prius-like emissions, which means it's a super ultra-low emissions vehicle, which means it produces about 95% less emissions than a current vehicle. It gets about 35 to 40 miles per gallon, comes with an 8-year
35 to 40 miles per gallon for an SUV.
For an SUV. This is a small size SUV. I haven't found seating because we're actually in the market right now for a 7-seater SUV or a 7-seater hybrid vehicle of some type. Toyota theoretically is coming out with one next year called the Highlander. But they haven't set a date yet. This one is set to come out in the summer. So again, no date set, no price set either. Although they are saying they're going to be making money on it. So does that mean
so it'll probably be pricey?
Yeah. Does that mean it's in the $30,000 range or the $20,000 range? I don't know. It's got all the standard stuff of regenerative braking, continuously variable transmission instead of a regular transmission.
Now, my first take on this was, they took Toyota's engine and put it in there.
That's what I thought too, since Toyota's been leasing out their hybrid system. But no, they actually say up on their website that they developed and
Ford did.
Yeah, and they generated 100 patents due to this new system. So
American ingenuity,
right? And
who'd have thunk it?
And it's got the. As opposed to Honda's system, it's following more of the Toyota system, where when you come up to a stoplight, the engine shuts off, and then when you accelerate, the engine remains in shut-off mode until it's needed, the gasoline engine. So therefore, it's an electric vehicle that has a gas assist, as opposed to the Honda vehicle, which is a gasoline vehicle, which has electric assist.
Interesting. Thank
and
you
and I hear it gets about 30 to 40 miles per gallon.
Right.
Thank you, John. Miles?
Well, Berkeley Systems Labs, or rather, some folks at UC Berkeley have come up with a solar cell that gets 50% efficiency.
50%?
50. Well, now, to give folks a point of context here, the previous record was 25%.
And these are the really expensive NASA cells, the 25%.
Right.
What do you know what the commercial ones are? Aren't they like 12%?
They're close, 12, 15, something like that. Yeah. And so basically what we're talking about in terms of overall power is sunlight will give 1.36 kilowatts.
Don't look at me for the
square meter.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe that's right. And so it comes out to if you have a square meter panel, mm-hmm. you'll be able to get 0.68 kilowatts.
Per square meter with 50%.
Right.
That's impressive. Thank you very much for that. I hadn't heard the story. I love it. Thank you, Miles.
Well, and if you consider that the sun produces, what is it, 18 zillion or 18 trillion kilowatts of kilowatt hours?
It's a question of how much you can get into a specific area.
Right.
Because you have...
So all you have to do is cover most of the sun with these things, and we're set.
Well, no, we just make a big sphere around the sun.
Dyson sphere. Thank you very much, Miles. Sean?
Yeah, Sony has announced a paper version of their Blu-ray disc.
Blu-ray disc, DVD. Blu-ray
correct.
Disc. Meaning they're printing on paper instead of plastic?
Yeah. Sony and a company called Toppin Printing have announced a 25-gig disc that's primarily made of paper.
Is that...
That's to bring print costs down and to help improve security.
I guess this is a one-time write, I'm assuming, a printed thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'd be easier to cut these things up if you wanted to.
Or burn them.
Or burn them.
Or get them wet.
Get them wet.
Interesting. So, I wonder why they're going that route. I mean,
the possibilities are endless.
I thought plastic was relatively cheap.
Well, paper's cheaper.
I guess so.
So I guess the applications really haven't been talked about. They plan on discussing, I guess, that and the details of the technology this weekend in Monterey at the Optical Data Storage Conference.
It's kind of neat to me that companies are producing technologies because they can. I mean, I don't know if there is an application really on that. But
oh, I'm sure there is.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
I'm sure that we'll be getting programs at
you don't spend
events
that kind of
and
money.
There'll be a CD in the program kind of thing.
Well, I wonder, actually,
DVD,
just because magnetic media and current optical media degrades, but we still have the Constitution and many other things. I'm wondering if paper actually has longer-term durability.
Here you go, books that have been around for thousands of years.
Yeah,
and that paper wasn't.
It's a
good
question of whether or not the ink stays and whether or not all the bits stay or whatever it is. But that may be a possibility.
I do have some 30-year-old punch cards. I don't have any 30-year-old CDs. So there you
go. Do you have any 25-gig 30-year-old punch cards?
No, I don't have that much room.
Thank you, Sean. John,
Apple is having a little bit of a problem with their new iPod Mini. They've sold over 400,000 of these units.
That doesn't sound like a problem.
Since it came out. That's not the problem. The problem is that some of the users are complaining about static sounds, sounds of static when they're listening to them. Apple does not have an answer to why this is happening yet, though. So we'll put this in the keep an eye on it.
So maybe not get a Mini right now.
Maybe not get a Mini until version 2 comes out. But then that's always my philosophy on
this. Especially on Apple. Thank you very much for that. Miles?
This one works for our security month. Quantum cryptography is out of the lab now and into the marketplace.
Whoa, cool.
You have a company called Magic Q and ID Quantique, who have set up systems that are up to 50 kilometers maximum distance right now, although they are fairly expensive, you know, upwards of $50,000 per unit. But basically, quantum computing is talking about you send, for example, I believe in their case, it's a photon over a long distance. And if someone tries to listen in on that conversation, the photon, by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, by someone observing it, it changes its state. It changes its either momentum or direction. And so that eavesdropping can be detected.
So basically it's a undetectable, I mean, a perfect security solution, if you
will. Well, it's a security solution where you know if someone's listening, so you can go, oh, someone's listening, I better stop talking.
Right. Great. Thank you, Miles, for that. We're going to do just a couple more items. Sean, your last item for today?
Yeah, Canon has announced that they're working on a new type of LCD monitor. They were one of the pioneers of the liquid crystal display, which is the flat panel that we all know, which is TFT, which is thin film transistor, where 1 to 4 transistors are used that are controlled for each pixel.
Mm-hmm.
This new technology is called, if I get this right here, Surface Conduction Electron Emitter Display.
That's a horrible acronym.
Or SED.
That's a good acronym.
That's better.
Don't ask me how it works because they really haven't discussed that yet. I guess it's very expensive and they're finding ways to make it cheaper. But what it will give you is a thinner, even a thinner display that uses less energy.
Very cool. Display technology improving. John?
Just want to let everyone know that next week is National Turn Off Your TV Week. So next week, keep your TV off. Find something else.
And keep your radio on.
Keep your radio on.
You're talking about broadcast TV, right? TiVo doesn't count, or movies.
Whatever
in a movie.
Computer monitors.
If you want information about it, go up to tvturnoff.org and see what they think is fair.
Great. Thank you very much. Miles, do you have one more story? Are we ready?
Yeah. Okay, the Federal Trade Commission adopts a new rule for sexually explicit spam.
Really?
Basically, they're putting in provisions to say that spam must be labeled, or sexually explicit spam must be labeled as such.
This is great, actually, because all the states have their own spam laws, and they all say that spam people have to put something at the top. It's all different. So can you imagine you're getting stuff from different states? You've got to learn what they are.
On the contrary, states used to, but the federal spam law overrode them, so they couldn't do that. So now the federal law is actually coming back to what states already had done.
Why am I getting so much spam, Miles?
Because you're wicked.
Okay.
Now, do you know what they're gonna have to label it with?
No.
I have no idea.
You know, I saw it in his story. It's up there. I'll have to look for it.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are John Tracy, Miles Elam, and Sean Cleveland. Personal computers are under continual attack by viruses, and as a computer user, you need to be aware of those threats and how to be safer. As product manager at Symantec, Craig Lane is responsible for the overall management of Symantec's consumer internet security solutions. He works to define product objectives and strategies for Norton Personal Firewall and Norton Internet Security. Lane also utilizes his vast knowledge of the internet security space to drive the development and introduction of new solutions to tackle emerging online threats. Previously, Lane was the product manager for Symantec Client Firewall. Craig Lane, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello, Lyle.
Yes. Thank you very much for joining us this morning on GeekSpeak. Craig, what is Norton Internet Security?
Well, in fact, Norton Internet Security is a package I normally like to recommend to our customers. It's really a combination of all the protection technologies you need on the Internet today. So it includes our traditional antivirus software, plus firewall and anti-spam capabilities as well.
Well, last week we talked a little bit on. Can you, if you have your computer radio on, can you turn that down?
No, I don't have it on.
Okay, we're getting quite an odd sound going on. I'm not sure why. We'll keep going, but we'll see how it lasts. Basically, last week on GeekSpeak we covered firewalls to some degree, and next week we're covering spam. So it's great to have you in here to talk a little bit about viruses, because your product also supports those other two things. Can we talk a little bit? I'd like you to talk a little bit about the threat right now from the Internet to a personal computer.
Yeah, in fact, there's a couple things going on. I think one thing that's going on is that we used to all have little tricks that we could protect ourselves from the Internet. So we'd know not to open up messages from people we didn't know, or maybe not click on attachments that look suspicious. some of the new technologies that the worms and viruses are using now, just by receiving an email, not even opening it, or going to a web page that you didn't intend to and realizing you're at the wrong site and just going immediately to another web page, those types of activities without any additional keystrokes or mouse clicks that you're going to do will infect your computer. So it's much harder for us to try to protect ourselves without using software.
Now, isn't that because the virus writers are taking advantage of bugs in software?
Exactly. That's exactly what's going on is we call them blended threats. They're using traditional virus techniques that have been around since the 80s, but they also added some of the mailing techniques and, in fact, are using some of the spamming techniques that really started in the late 90s to get viruses to move around a lot. And then, like the blaster worm that we saw last year, they're also starting to use these operating system or even application vulnerabilities. And those are, I think, the most dangerous because those are the ones that require no user interaction at all. Your computer just has to be turned on and connected to the Internet, and now it can be infected.
And that's really an essential one if you need to for having a firewall.
Yeah, well, actually, firewalls are one of the layers of security, and I think that's why I really like to recommend our Norton Internet Security Package is for most people, they don't want to worry about, well, what does a firewall block and what does an antivirus software block, and if I get products from two companies, are they overlapping well? And so I think most people just want to buy one box and say, protect me from everything.
One software package, right?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about how traditionally your Norton antivirus is with the product I know of, and I know that you're kind of bundling this to make it a more cohesive solution, but let's talk a little about antivirus. What is some of the features that, like, the Norton antivirus part of your suite does?
I think that the most important feature to look for in any antivirus product, especially, but this also is good for any security product, is to make sure they can keep it up to date, whatever vendor you choose, and then especially if it has a feature that will automatically keep the product up to date. I think one of the most popular features in Norton Antivirus is our live update feature, and we even have an auto live update feature so that if your computer's on and it's connected to the Internet, it'll be checking about on a four-hour basis to see if there's new virus information available from Symantec. It'll download that and update your computer already.
Now, we talk about virus definitions, which is what you're talking about, this updates from the company virus definition. What is that real file that's being downloaded when the application asks for a virus definition update? What is that?
Well, actually, what we do is when we get a report of a new virus, we actually kind of tear it apart and look what's inside of it. What we'll try to do is we'll find some unique things in that virus. And then what we'll do is when a file is downloaded to your computer, you're trying to load a program into memory to run it, we'll actually scan through that file the same way that a computer reads the file in to execute the code that's in it. So we'll actually follow the same kind of logic that your CPU follows to execute the program. And that way we can actually find the pieces of virus code and not trip over other components in the file that might change all the time.
Now, is that when the application is run or when the application is loaded on your computer?
Well, actually, depending on your antivirus software, you can configure it in many different ways. We try to make ours so it's right when you install it right out of the box, all the settings are done to give you the best security. So we actually will look at it as you're copying the file from, let's say, one disk to another, or you're downloading it from the Internet to your computer. So not even when it's in a runnable state, we'll be scanning it.
Now some performance flags are kind of raising up for me. It's like, doesn't it take a lot more time for your computer to do things when it has to do this extra layer of checking everything it's doing? It has to check before it copies the file, as it's copying a file, and it has to check when it starts executing a file. Doesn't that add some performance problems to the processing of your machine?
Yep, that does. Like you said, there's a little bit of extra work we're doing that we can't avoid. What we've been doing over the last 19 years or so is we've been making that process as efficient as we can. So that, but I think all security measures, we always talk about adding layers of security, and even the lock on your front door of your house slows you down a little bit as you're entering it because you have to stop and unlock it. But
and
most
and
people
I gotta
would
say,
never leave.
This is Sean speaking.
It's nice to hear that there's something extra that our processor, our 2 and 3 gigahertz processors, can do. You know.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing is,
you know, anyone that's got anything faster than the 2 gigahertz processor is not going to notice. Most likely, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah, but I think that's really what we've been trying to do is make the antivirus software, in fact, our security software in general, do its job but be as invisible as we can to the person using it day to day so they get the benefits of it but try not to make them pay any price for it. In performance, at least, right?
We're speaking with Craig Lane from Symantec. We're talking about virus protection and security on your computer. Craig, when your application is checking a file being copied from, let's say, a floppy, not that that happens very much, or copied from a share onto your machine, how does the actual software tie into the operating system so that the operating system tells it, yeah, by the way, this is happening? Is it a lot of tricks and neat things, or does Microsoft support kind of this infrastructure?
In fact, most of the operating systems support this type of infrastructure. Is they have a series of services that they provide to open up files and to assign memory to different applications. So we plug into those so that we can see as a file is being opened or closed, we can kind of step in and say, well, here, let us scan it first before you signal to the rest of the operating system that that file's been opened or it's been loaded into memory. So we can kind of pause it for a second, do our work, and then let it continue after we're done.
Okay. What about viruses coming in through email? Is the same type of thing? You connect with the email client?
Exactly. In fact, the way I kind of look at our computers is really kind of two big doors. Where actually, I kind of look at it as a door and a window. We've always had the door of file-based stuff, and you know, since the 80s, we've had floppy disks. We've exchanged files with each other. When the Internet started, we started downloading files, kind of treating the Internet like a big hard disk. And then email started up with sending file attachments back and forth. So all those file type methods of getting things into your computer are really covered by antivirus. And what you guys talked about last with the firewalls, that's really the network window to your computer. There's a bunch of things that now can come from the network into your computer, so that's another window or door to it, and that's what the firewall kind of steps in front of and tries to protect and inspect that traffic coming in and out of that
And it makes sense. It's like the firewall kind of is the, well, we don't want this kind of stuff to come into the computer at all. And the antivirus is, well, we're going to get stuff coming in that we want, but we want to make sure that we check them and test them to make sure that they're not dangerous. That's basic?
Yeah, in fact, both technologies need to have two different things. In fact, this is another thing I like to look for in my security software is there's a pendulum that swings back and forth of what's called a signature based solution, which is normally the antivirus, and those signatures or those definitions that we were talking about. And then there's another class of security software that works on behaviors. And really a firewall is a behavior-based technology because it talks about different things that you should or shouldn't be communicating with. So it's looking for bad behavior on the Internet, where antivirus software has traditionally been a signature-based technology. We're scanning files for specific signatures that identify the virus. And really in our antivirus software and now in our firewall software, we've actually combined both those models so that with our antivirus software, we have a feature that tries to detect new worms that we don't know about by the behavior that they're doing. And that's one way that we collect a lot of the worms for the very first time so that we can provide those signatures. And then our firewall technology also has a component that not only blocks traffic wholesalely, because normally a firewall says, I'm going to let everything through, I'm going to let nothing through. We have a technology that inspects each packet that's coming through your network so that we can let some good traffic through on some ports, but then also block on that same port bad traffic that's coming through also.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit more detailed about antivirus part of it, that client that sits on the computer that's running all the time and getting updates and definitions. We actually had someone through our email system, through sending us email by going to geekspeak.org and clicking on the geeks and then clicking on send a message. We had Chris. He says he regularly runs Norton virus definitions, gets new Norton virus definitions. He regularly scans his computer for viruses, and to date he's never detected a virus. However, periodically, he says, in my major screen name for AOL, I get messages saying, the mail daemon, or Varian, saying a message could not be sent and shows a lot of MIME-type stuff at the bottom of the email. But he's not sending any of those emails. What could these failure-to-send messages be when I cannot detect any viruses trying to send messages? Very curious from Chris. Can you address that, Craig?
Yeah, without a little bit more information, it's hard to say what's really going on there. But what a lot of companies are doing now, and by companies I mean the kind of ISP for internet service providers, they're all providing some antivirus scanning capabilities on their mail servers. In fact, Symantec actually provides those services and those same products that we sell to the big companies that are, you know, run mail servers for their employees. And that's part of these layers of security. So it's a good thing to have your ISP searching for viruses on their mail server, but it's also good to have your computer searching for viruses also, because you might get something outside of an email. So there might be their scanning technology on their server seeing something suspicious and rejecting the mail.
That's probably what's happening. What also happened was that the original virus author, the headers for the mail were forged. In other words, probably a virus got onto someone who knows Chris, and it went through his address book. It started looking at all the different people in the address book and started sending mail in their name. So when it got the bounce back, Chris gets the bounce back instead of the original computer that sent the virus. It's a way of obfuscating where
Chris,
it came from.
Chris from AOL complaint. I think Miles is right on the money on that. It's probably what's happened is that someone else's machine is infected. Because if you have Norton antivirus, you probably aren't infected. But someone else's machine is infected, and they're sending out mail, and some of the mail they're sending out is in your name. And some of the mail that's being sent out in your name is being detected as, oh, this has a virus on it. And so the scanning software that's scanning that just sees the from address as being you, even though you didn't send it, and is sending the message back to you saying this was infected. So most likely, it's kind of like this breathe easier state when you have virus protection on your machine, especially for scanning all the time. You'll probably find someone else isn't. So if you only have five people that know your email address, contact all of them. But more likely, it's someone you wouldn't really be able to pin down. Craig, does that sound like a...
Yeah, but I think that is a really good explanation, because, in fact, you're seeing a lot more of those types of things going on with... in fact, that was one of the spamming kind of techniques I was talking about earlier, is the virus guys are also learning the lessons that the spam guys are, is trying to get their messages out and sneaking through, you know, people's layers of defenses. So that's probably a really good explanation that you guys gave.
Now, Craig, I'm really curious about this virus definition thing. You said that it's kind of like a signature for the virus, and Norton, what happens is some group goes, oh, we found a new virus, and you start dissecting it, and you find that little key signature, and then you figure out, oh, yeah, all these signatures will exist in all the applications, so we'll put that into our definitions and send it out to people. Doesn't that definition file start getting pretty big?
In fact, that was a real big problem in the past years. We had, because we've been in this antivirus business for a while, and in fact, way back in the middle 80s, we started getting into several thousand viruses that we're trying to scan for. And so for some of your listeners, you can just imagine if you're searching through just Word documents for a common phrase, that's a kind of similar activity. That's a lot of searching to do. So that's what we've concentrated a lot of our technologies into using these faster processors to do multiple things.
And is there? I mean, so I'm assuming that this work of downloading the definitions and running it, doesn't it mean that the application has to be pretty smart about how it looks for different things? I mean, I can imagine that some viruses are going to have a signature that's easy to find, and some are going to be a more complicated signature that might not just be, you know, we're looking for these bytes in this order, but some other kind of pattern in the application. So is that true, that they're kind of more complex than just looking for a string?
Exactly. In fact, we really try to look at how this infection technique has to be run, because what happens, like we were talking about earlier, is some of these operating system vulnerabilities that the viruses are using today, they have to be exploited in a very particular way or it doesn't work. So we can actually... As we start looking for things, we don't actually have to scan through the whole file for every single signature. We can say, you know, this signature only works if it's in kind of this area. So we can look at that really quick, and then if we don't find it, we can skip on to the next one. So there's lots of little shortcuts like that to make sure that we only find the virus code that actually can be run, And in fact, this is another thing that will go into the reduction of what we call false positives.
All right, we'll go into that. We'll go into that in just a moment. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can, of course, use the Internet. Visit geekspeak.org, click on the Geeks, and then click on Send a Message. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, and John Tracy, and our guest Craig Lane, product manager of Semantic via phone. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing Internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL, now with nationwide access. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. We're taking your calls and questions pertaining to viruses and security threats for your home computer, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Craig Lane, product manager of Semantic, is with us via phone. And Craig, you were just talking about false positives or trying to eliminate false positives. Can you talk about what false positive with respect to virus searching is?
Yeah, a false positive, kind of like its name implies, means that we've incorrectly identified a file that has a virus in it and that file really doesn't have a virus in it. And that's, you can imagine, really maddening to our customers. So it's something that we've done a lot of work on over the years to make sure that when our product does trigger on a virus, it really is a virus there. And so that's part of this technology. Not only does it help us scan through the several thousand signatures much quicker, but we can also now, if there's something that looks like that virus signature, but it happens to be in a part of the file that can only contain data but not executable code, we can skip over it, and that helps prevent those false positives from being triggered.
How do you actually look at executable code?
Well, actually, what we do is we follow the same procedure that the CPU follows. And so even if there's buffer overflows or some of the illegal things that happen in code that even the developers didn't expect, since we're going to follow the same rules that the CPU does in executing it, we'll see just the same bits of that little file that have executable code. Because you can imagine some programs have the code that's going to execute, plus they might also have some data that has to do with maybe some of the settings that you've had set in the program, and that stuff will change, so you don't want to trigger on that incorrectly.
Mm-hmm. We have Gene from Watsonville on line one. Gene, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. I have a question about the automatic updating. A friend had warned me that that's, in general, not a good idea to do because when the... somehow or other, they could look at other things on your computer. So are you going to snoop around on my computer? How do I know that it's safe to do that?
And so that's your concern. So you have
and is there a problem in general with automatic updating with other companies?
Craig, can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of people that are concerned with privacy issues on the Internet.
Yeah.
So, in fact, any company that you do... transactions with, I like to go and read their privacy policy. Good companies will have very clear stated privacy policies of what they're going to inspect or not inspect from you. If a company doesn't have that posted, it should make you a little concerned.
Oh, okay.
And then one thing that you can also kind of differentiate is some of the, especially the security products, they update information that helps them find, let's say, new viruses or worms. There's other kind of updates that you can get for operating system or applications that fix these vulnerabilities inside. Some people are cautious with those because that's going to change the way, let's say, Microsoft Windows works. And some people have had bad experiences with an update that where everything's working fine, they update their computer, and then it stops working. So normally with the antivirus or security updates, you don't have to worry about that type of behavior because it's just getting new information about how to find new viruses and not really changing the way the software works.
Right. It's not like you wouldn't want one of those updates.
Yeah. So that's why, in fact, we have the automatic updates turned on. They're very tiny. Okay. If you're on the Internet, you don't even really know it's happening. We'll have a little box that comes up and tells you that we're done.
And Gene, from a balanced point of view, if you will, mm-hmm. I don't work for a virus protection company, I would say that the one application that you really do want to have auto updating all the time, or basically it's just the definitions, but auto updating would be your virus protection software. Everything else, I would say, yes, you probably want to be kind of in control of that. For example, sometimes a security patch from your OS vendor like Microsoft, very necessary thing to have. You totally want it, and it could break an old thing that you're relying upon, like a scanner. It's not very likely, but it's possible. So let's say you're in the middle of a really big week of work, and you're scanning all this stuff, and this update happens from Microsoft, and presto, you have no scanner. That's the time where you might want to control that. At the same time, those updates from OS is what we're talking about. We've been kind of talking with Craig about is this firewall protection you need, because lots of these vulnerabilities allow that security update from Microsoft would fix. Without that, you're vulnerable to these things that can just find your machine on the net and infect them. So I would definitely recommend updating stuff from Microsoft, but more importantly, from whatever your antivirus protection software is, have that thing being auto-updates.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call.
And I got to say, I run Norton Antivirus. My company provides it for all the employees. I run it in the background all the time, and it auto-updates. I never have a problem with it.
We, again, have someone, Bruce from Seaside. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, thank you. I think I'm on.
You are.
Okay. This is a question about the Norton product itself. We've used it for a number of years with very good success. However, lately, it does take cycles in the background. It does take some processing power, and it's gotten to the point where the slowdown is noticeable. And what we're talking about is a difference in compile time for some of the applications we developed between 1 minute and about 2 minutes.
Bruce, where do you work?
I work for a software company called Center Stage Software.
Okay. And so you're noticing, and do you know that it's Norton Antivirus?
Yeah. Yeah, we can go through the task list,
uh-huh.
and we can see the tasks running in the background, and we can turn them off, and it'll speed back up again.
Well, Craig, do you want to address this?
Yeah, in fact, I've actually heard this comment before. In fact, this is something that we look into really seriously because, like I were saying earlier, we want to make our software as invisible as possible. It's really, I think, one of its secrets of success. One of the things I've noticed, in fact, this has happened to me on one of my own personal machines at home, is I installed Windows XP on it, and Windows XP takes a lot more memory. So when I installed some of my security applications or other things that run in the background that do things for me, that includes drivers for some of my hardware, it put me into low memory mode, so I ended up in a lot more swapping. So that could be going on, this is something that we constantly look at as we continually add more protection. We want to make sure that we take as little system resources as possible.
And right now, Craig, do you have something in the pending queue that people have been complaining lately of the most recent update that something's slowed down? Or is this kind of just a general thing that you're always battling?
I think there's a little bit of both. Is for every release that we come out with, we really watch for installation problems or other complaints from customers to see if we made a mistake or there's something that we have to address. I think also another thing that kind of goes on constantly is people update their software and they don't update their hardware. So as the software kind of out, they get a little bit more capabilities, their hardware gets a little bit slower, then they buy their new hardware cycle. But some people will buy software on a shorter cycle than they buy their hardware on. So they'll see a little bit of slowdown until they get that new CPU. Then they'll be happy again for the next year, but then they'll start seeing that creepy slowdown over the next 2 years that they're owning that machine. Let's say if they own their machines 3 years or 4 years at a time.
Bruce, what
that's exactly what's happened here.
Yeah.
The machine is it's a rather old, venerable, it's a 1 gigabyte Athlon processor, and it's got, I think, 256 megabytes of RAM in it, and I try and keep it as clean as possible, but...
Are you running XP?
No, in this case, I'm running Windows 98. I have philosophical problems with Windows XP.
98, huh? Well, you could, of course, go ahead and dump more RAM on that machine, but...
I've got stuff there that are very specifically Norton, and they're very difficult to pull out because you've got to do searches through the registry.
Right.
And registry searches and modifying the registry is not something for faint-hearted people.
No.
You can also get other virus programs that don't constantly try to update themselves, because I know Norton is constantly scanning. You can get Sophos makes a product that it sits in the background and then runs at scheduled times. You can schedule exactly when to run and exactly when to update. So you can have it do it at lunch or, you know, when you first turn on your computer and get your coffee or whatever.
Yeah, but, and one other thing I noticed that you, in your example, you mentioned that it was during compile times. Compiling is opening and closing lots of files and producing files. So one thing you might want to do if that's taking 45 minutes or an hour to compile a big set of software, you might want to scan the machine before it. Then you could turn off that automatic scanner. And then as a additional safety, you might want to scan it at the end. But that will give you a good before and after scan, but not have to scan all the files during the process of the compiling, which might be opening and closing them a lot.
Yeah, well, actually, the long-term solution is that we're going to Linux.
That would solve the problem. Then you wouldn't get any viruses.
Yeah, the Linux machines operate so much faster. It's just incredible.
Now, Bruce, one more thing. When I was running 98, and I think all the geeks were doing that when they were running in 98, is you reinstall the operating system every once in a while.
It's just because one of those things you have to do.
Yeah, because it gets the machine faster again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. No question about that.
Bruce, thank you very much for the call. Good luck. And I'm happy to hear that a developing company is going to Linux. That's great. Thank you, Bruce.
Yeah. Is Miles there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. I'd like to send you some email, which you can answer off the air.
Sure. MilesGeekSpeak.org.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, Craig, I have a question for you.
All right.
We've come across viruses that the autoscan did not find. We only found it with the manual scan. Is that different, the manual scan?
Actually, the manual scan does do some additional things. As we were talking about earlier, that automatic scan, in fact, any scan is going to take up some cycles, so that there's some more rigorous scanning that we can do, and we actually save that for the manual scan. In fact, that's why we recommend that you do that on a semi-regular basis.
How regular do you recommend?
I recommend that people do that at least once a month.
Do you have the ability to say, you know, do a scan, and when you're done doing the scan, turn my computer off? Is that is that part of the feature of the product?
I don't believe we have that in there, but that's kind of a good suggestion.
A great thing to do. Because
McAfee can do that.
Yeah, McAfee? Okay,
yeah.
That's good. I love that idea, because then you can just do the scan right, you know, you're going to sleep and you're doing the scan, and in the morning when you boot your machine, you get some message saying these are the things we found last night, but it shut the machine down over the night.
Now, we actually have a scheduling feature built into our security software that allows you to do scans at, you know, different times of the day, like you were saying, maybe during your lunch hour, at night when you're sleeping. That feature actually can turn it off at the end of a scheduled scan. I'm not sure that you can just, let's say, decide you're going to bed, say, scan this, and then have it shut off all automatically just by hitting the button. But you can do that with the scheduler.
That's what I was thinking of through McAfee, is their scheduler that allows you to do the same.
Yeah, I've seen that at Cabrillo's Computer Labs.
Mm-hmm. But actually, I like that idea of just hit the scan button and say, when you're done, shut it off, because then I could just do that when as an additional way to shut my computer down.
John, primarily you're a Macintosh user. Uh-huh. So John Tracy, one of the geeks here. What virus protection software do you use?
Virus protection software? What's that? No, I don't run anything.
Because you're on a Mac?
Because I'm on a Mac.
Eventually, you'll get hit with a virus. Everybody will.
What about that Trojan horse?
You know, this is a question I want to ask. How many viruses come out in a month or in a year? Is there any kind of demographic on it? And where do they come from?
Yeah, we probably get 7 to 10 a day that come out, and it really varies between the different times of the year. There's an interesting thing going on right now where two virus writers are having a public war with each other inside their viruses. So they're insulting each other. One virus is actually looking for the other and turning it off.
So these are people who apparently don't have IM.
And
they
yes, exactly.
Contact each other through viruses. Okay.
This is like the East West Coast rap thing.
I wonder who they are.
So, yeah, where are these viruses coming from?
Well, in fact, they actually come from all over the place. And one thing I find interesting is in the past, I think viruses used to be more or less like electronic graffiti. They would come to your machine, maybe do a little vandalism, delete things or throw up little messages. Now really what's happening is criminals are moving to the Internet, and they're not satisfied with just damaging your computer. They want to steal money from your bank account and do other things like that, even take out loans on your house, because they've gotten enough information to to do that to you.
So theft, identity theft.
Exactly, identity theft, or what's being called phishing with a PH now, is getting more and more common.
Phishing with a what?
PH.
It's a phishing with, spelled with a PH.
It was like phishing.
It was like you get a letter from like eBay. This happened to me last week, where you get a letter from eBay that says, please update your account information. You log into a site that looks very, very similar to the site you're used to, and it asks for all the personal information they need to steal your identity.
Or rather identical, except for the URL.
Right.
Because they've stolen the graphics from the main site.
Is that phishing?
That's phishing.
Yeah, that's exactly the definition of phishing. You normally will get a spam message that says, in fact, if there's normally some urgency to it, you're going to lose your email account that night, your bank account's going to be closed the next day unless you respond. So they try to make you respond to it very quickly before you're thinking. But and like you were pointing out, the website looks identical because they can really go to that vendor's website and click on their graphics and download them and produce a site that looks identical to a banking site or an ISP site, your insurance company. In fact, all the big popular consumer banks have been hit by these phishing attacks, in some cases 4 or 5 different ones in a single week.
You're listening to Craig Lane. He's the product manager of Symantec. The geeks in the house are Miles, John, and Sean. My name's Lyle Troxell. And Sean has a question for you, Craig.
Yeah, Craig, how hard would it be to add a tool that looks at an email and tells you where it's from or validates that it's from the source that you know? Let's say you get something from eBay. You want to make sure that it was sent from eBay. I mean, is there something that you can look at the header information and tell you, you know, the typical person, whether, you know, this could be from a different place, different
That's
source?
That's actually a real good question. There are some new technologies that are coming out that try to do some fingerprinting or what's being called kind of caller IDs for email, so you can actually tell a little bit better where they're coming from. One of the things we were talking about earlier is the spam guys do this quite a bit, that you can actually look at that email header, and what you're supposed to be able to do is actually see the path from the person that sent the mail, every computer it touched on the Internet as it went through it on the way to your computer. And what the bad guys are doing now is they'll take that little header and they'll monkey with it on the way. And
right.
So, in fact, that's what we talked about earlier, how all of a sudden your from address can send up on a message that you never sent. But when you inspect that, it actually does look like you sent it. And that's one of the things that anti-spam programs do, is they really chew apart that header looking for weird things in it. So you'll see, if you look at it as a human, you'll see this big list of maybe 30 or 40 computers that are between the sender and the receiver of an email. And it looks all good to you, but we can actually go look to see that each chain is linked to the previous link and that there's no mysterious breaks in the chain someplace.
Right, right.
We have Maria from Santa Cruz. Maria, welcome to Geek Speak. Maria, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, what is your question?
Is it important to turn off a DSL when you turn off your computer? Will leaving your DSL line operating be dangerous for hackers to get in, or can viruses sneak in, or can people go through your computer even though it's off but you leave your DSL on?
Craig?
That's probably a little bit more rare. Is a lot of people, in fact, leave their computers on and their DSL or cable modems on. One thing that we're actually on the lookout for is if you do turn off your computer and let's say you have a cable modem or DSL modem, or what's more popular now with people getting the little home network routers or wireless connections at home, those devices actually have a little bit of small amount of memory. They can get updates from their vendors. We're looking for exploits to those that actually might happen in the future, where your router itself or your cable modem gets infected and it waits for your computer to come on and then finishes the infection once your computer turns on.
That is insidious.
And we actually haven't seen that yet, but that's something that we're expecting to see.
Maria? The short answer is, if your computer's off, your computer's totally fine.
But,
don't worry about it.
But if you have a wireless connection, that'll be available, and people can't access it if it's not protected.
But, Maria, do you have a DSL modem connected directly to your computer?
Yes.
That situation, you're fine. You don't have to turn the modem off.
Okay.
The only thing I can think of would a wake on LAN signal come in over DSL?
Yeah, it could.
But that would be coming from your ISP. That seems...
No, it could be. I mean, if the DSL modem's always connected. But
it's true.
She's probably using... PPOE, so I wouldn't concern yourself about it, Maria.
Right.
What Craig is saying is that, yes, it is possible for that piece of hardware to get infected with a virus. But I've never heard of something like that happening. I don't think that's something that you have to concern yourselves about. I think the security expert should be aware of it. And if that ever does happen, you'll probably know about it pretty quickly.
Okay. Last week I thought I heard you say, why would you leave your DSL on when you turn your computer off? Did you or did you not?
I did say that. And the reason is
It was a rhetorical question.
It was a rhetorical question, yeah. But basically, you don't need to turn that piece of hardware off. If you're leaving for a week, yeah, go ahead and unplug it. You're just going to waste energy. You're not using it anyway. But in general, no, I would just leave that piece of equipment plugged in.
Oh. Okay.
If it's like daily kind of thing.
But it doesn't hurt it if you do turn it off.
No, it should be fine.
Okay.
You have the sync time to come up.
Yeah,
again,
but you have your computer boot time, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you turn on your modem before you turn on computer, that's the only thing I'm concerned about. Make sure that your modem's on for at least a minute before you power on your computer.
Oh.
Because the reason for that, well, it doesn't really necessarily matter with today's operating systems, but it could potentially be problematic for you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Maria, for the
Thank
call.
Thank you.
Now, Craig, I didn't mean to trump you. That sounds like a totally cool or insidious thing going on with the idea of infecting hardware. Are you seeing any cases, test samples, where that's happening yet?
We actually have seen some kind of proof of concept types of things, which is why we know it's possible and we're looking for it. But just to kind of reinforce your advice, I actually leave my cable modem at home on all the time. Even if I have several machines on a home network, even if they're all off, and unless I'm going on vacation, that box is on because it's up in a room upstairs I don't go into too often.
And you feel relatively safe doing that?
Yep, I feel totally safe, partly because I try to run security software on all my computers at home. So as long as I have security software on the computer, it's going to catch that router infection.
Miles has a question for you,
Craig.
Yeah,
now I'm truly intrigued by that DSL gateway kit being infected. It was my understanding that they don't allow access to the outside unless you've actually made it available, made administration available to the outside.
Most of the time the defaults are that way, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's how the software is designed to work, but there's actually, they'll have the same kind of vulnerabilities that software has in the software that's driving that piece of hardware.
I mean, it's possible for the
buffer overflows to them and other things like that actually can get into their volatile memory.
And then you theoretically update your own BIOS to them or update your own upgrade to them, and then which might just allow you to open up all the ports that you want to have open. And if someone's relying upon that as being their hardware firewall and all of a sudden someone's been able to tamper with it, then you can open up a security into their network. That's basically what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, in fact, the technique that we actually saw was something as simple as changing where your default DNS server is. So now you're talking to this evil DNS server that's going to start looking for additional ways to pump in packets through your port 53 to start doing these other types of OS vulnerabilities.
Well, I don't want to, we're kind of going off track here, unfortunately, even though it's a great subject. A little bit more about virus stuff.
How do you find them?
Yeah.
You must have engineers there looking for viruses, but
new viruses we're talking about.
Do people submit these viruses, and how do they do that?
Yeah, how do you find 10 a day?
Yeah, in fact, we actually added a feature to Norton Antivirus a few years ago that has turned out to be not only great protection for our customers, but a great way for us to collect new viruses. A lot of viruses spread now with that mass mailing technique. That's a way that they can really spread quickly. In fact, a lot of times they don't use your email client. They actually contain their own little email client within the virus or worm itself. So whenever we see especially a file mailing itself, and this is some of the behavior stuff I was talking about earlier, we can see bad behavior. We'll actually grab that file, and with the customer's permission, we'll submit that automatically to Symantec. And that actually does two things for them. We'll look at it real quickly. If we've already detected it and we have a signature for it, we'll immediately send back a signature to that machine within a second, and that file will then be taken care of. If it's a new one, it actually goes to whatever security operating center we have open at that moment. We have them around the world so we can have both local people looking at it, and there's always somebody awake looking at it. They'll decompose it very quickly and come up with a new virus signature, and that will normally come out within the hour.
Yeah, wow.
Great. Thank you. Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. Craig Lane from Symantec, thank you very much for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
Well, thanks for having me as a guest, Lyle. This is very fun.
One of the other things that your product that you manage, Norton's Internet Security, handles is spam. And next week we are talking about spam. Not with you, but I do appreciate you coming on. And if people want to learn about Symantec, it is www.symantec.com. You can also get there from going to geekspeak.org and clicking on Symantec. Craig, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Lyle.
The Geeks Today, Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Sean Cleveland. Guys, thanks.
Thank you, Lyle.
Good to be here.
Our producer and phone answer is Maggie Cleveland. And thank you all for participating in GeekSpeak. To those of you that called in and emailed in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. We do this because of you, and I love doing the show. So thanks for listening and contributing. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KDBH, San Arto. We're on the web at KUSP.org. The month of April for GeekSpeak is home security. Last week was firewalls. This week is viruses. Next week we're talking about spam. Not that exactly a security thing, but to some degree it is. And we'll get into details a little bit more about that next week. For GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Fine Print with Jan Remage is coming up next, followed by State of the Arts with my mother, Diana Wright Troxell. And at noon, my favorite music show, Two Steps from the Blues with Charlie Lang. Friday's a great day, as is every day, to listen to KUSP. Stay tuned now for Fine Print.